Welcome to Wine About History. I'm your host, Max Hamill. And regrettably, Patty is not with me today. She had some family matters to take care of because of COVID-19. So I will be a solo episode today. Now, today we are covering... Now, there's a bit of argument about nomenclature about this. The Anasazi people, also known as the Ancestral Pueblos. But because they're mostly known as the Anasazi, I'm going to refer to them as that. Not of any disrespect, it's just the popular name. And some their descendants take some issue with it because it means, literally in Navajo, or there as they call themselves, the Diné people, ancestors are enemies because they're in competition with the Hopi and the Zuni and the other descendants of the Anasazi. And we are drinking. I may have drunk this already in the podcast, but it's an individual episode, so it doesn't count. Exodus, 2016. It's good red wine, aged in bourbon barrels for 3 months. I like it. I believe I said I liked it last time. Or maybe I just drank it, because if you haven't noticed, I like wine. You can definitely taste the dark fruit in there. And the smokiness of it being aged in that barrel. If you enjoy red wines like this, I definitely recommend this. If you're not someone that likes dark red wines with a lot of oaky flavor, you might want to stay away from this one. But so far, of all the wines I've tasted, it's been my favorite. Liked it so much, I got a second bottle. Back to the Anasazi people. Now, they were a people that dominated the region that kind of centers around the Colorado Plateau, extends from central New Mexico on the east and then southern Nevada to the west. And it's a big region, especially for that style of civilization. And they dominated the area from the year 700 AD to 1130 AD, and lived in very impressive stone cities and towns. One of the best preserved is a place called Chaco. And the populace lived in apartment-like stone houses with an agrarian empire. I believe they're mostly farmers. And they weren't simple stone homes like the Scottish Brokes. They were many-storied and multi-purposed. And they had big plazas, and then there were religious houses called kivas. They were underground, and some of them were as big as 63 feet in diameter. And what you're doing is you're going underground to talk to the spirits in underground, and perhaps some of them in the underworld. Now, in Chaco, there are these great houses, and these great houses show that there was an elite class there. That's what the archaeologists believe. But archaeologists, they're not always right about things. And they found musical instruments, jewelry, ceramics, and ceremonial items. And they hosted indoor burials there where these gifts were placed to the dead. And everything from bowls of food to turquoise beads. And the Anasazi, or Ancestral Pueblos, turquoise beads are fascinating. They still don't know how they made them. I love that. I love it when any non-modern society stumps modern technology. But the beads were turquoise, but they think they took hours polishing them with grass. And then there's a tiny, really tiny hole in the center, but it's about as thin as a human hair in some of these beads. So that shows a lot of skill and talent and patience. Now, back to the cities. The houses had about several core traits. They're very big. They averaged 200 rooms each. Some had up to 700 rooms. And the individual rooms were large in size and with high ceilings. They were well planned, and they had large sections and wings and other sorry. Just evidence that they were very well planned out. Not unlike a Victorian manor or a modern skyscraper. They also had a vast 400-mile road system that seemed to be, it was very big and extensive. And some archaeologists argue that it was not for practical use, but it was for spiritual significance. But that's something archaeologists and historians say whenever they can't explain something. I was in archaeology classes and historical classes, and whenever they can't explain something, they just say it had spiritual significance. And then they grade you badly on your homework. Or if you're like me, you didn't do it. Now, a golden age was reached in the Anasazi. Approximately around the year 900 to 100-150. This is also known as Puebla Era 2. And this is where they had a vast trading network. They had domesticated turkeys. They rose in power. It was sort of, you know, you've heard of Pax Romana. This was Pax Anasazi. And they did a lot of trading. There shows that their influence grew. Then, around 1250 AD, they fled their undefendable homes and carved out vast, impressive cliffside fortresses. These fortresses are beautiful, but they're carved quite deliberately into the cliffside. And it's obvious that they're defensive structures. They're very hard to get to. Normally, they have just a small ladder that would be pulled up at night. So if that ladder wasn't there, you were not getting up there. And some of them, they would have the ladder and then foot and toe holds to climb up. So it would be even harder to get up there if you brought your own ladder. And there's little evidence to say as to why they fled. This is why I did the episodes. We're in keeping with our abandoned towns and cities theme. Historians have suggested anything from Aztec invasion, raids from other southwestern peoples, deforestation. We do know that earlier the water table changed, and for some abandonments of cities in that ancestral Pueblo Golden Age. Now, Pueblo traditions say that their ancestors achieved great spiritual power and they had a lot of control over natural forces, but they used their power incorrectly and caused nature to change, and these changes were never meant to happen. And what's interesting about this is this tradition falls in line with some evidence because there are great kivas, which were the heart of their ceremonies and very, very important religious structures. Many of them were destroyed. The underground roofs were ripped up and they were burned from the inside out. Keep in mind, some of these structures were 63 feet in diameter. They were not small. And so that points to that the tradition does have some truth or some evidence to its truth. Modern Pueblo people, you know, the Hopi, the Tanoans, the Zuni, they say their ancestors didn't vanish. And that's just something done to popularize it in media, which I happen to agree with. They say that their people just migrated to more favorable rainfall areas and dependable streams. And that makes more sense than them fleeing some Aztec invasion. But you never know. It could have been all of those things. In fact, if the water table dropped, that would cause more competition, which would explain the fleeing into the defendable homes. Then if the things became more desperate, it would be very smart and very wise thing to do to go play somewhere where the water table is better. Now, take everything I say here with a grain of salt, because I went through article after article after article, not just reputable articles, mind you, reputable articles, and did research with ebooks, and I found a lot of conflicting evidence, because that's something that happens in history. scholars don't agree. They get angry with each other and they say, no, you're wrong, you're right. So there are different theories to everything. If you like red wine, get a bottle. So you guys ever listening to me lecture and rant and rave and you hear me pause? I'm taking a sip of wine. I can't stop. Some of this stuff is so good that I just have to take a sip of it. You can really taste the that smokiness in this. Now, proceeding. Now, a 1997 excavation in Cowboy Wash, which I'm not familiar with the area is, but it's near Dolores, Colorado, and I love Colorado. I've been there. They found the remains of 24 skeletons that showed, you know, they examined them. You can see this on a skeleton of violence, you know, someone's head's caved in, and dismemberment, and some indications of cannibalism. Now, the indications of cannibalism are evidence of scraping along a bone with a knife. And you can see that in a skeleton. I've seen it in classes and lectures where they show you how to see wounds, injuries, because a lot of it's left on the bones. If you get attacked by a boar, it's going to cut into your leg, and you're going to see the difference between the rough tusk of a boar or the fine cut of a flint knife and obsidian knives. Obsidian knives, by the way, can be sharpened to 1 micron by experts. A human hair is 100 microns. So that's how sharp some of these knives are. They're gonna leave a distinctive impression. And this small community near Cowboy Wash shows that this happened around that abandonment time. And other diggings and other in ancestral Pueblo areas have found, you know, similar evidence, not necessarily cannibalism, but just unburied people, which is very rare. And some cases, dismemberment. So it looks like while whatever caused them to flee, whether it's just competition for resources or an invasion, they were desperate. They're doing something all desperate people do, which is, if you have to, you know, commit acts of cannibalism on the enemy, or maybe it was ritualistic, or maybe they were just desperate. And just, you know, hacking apart enemies and running away is something a lot of people do. You know, there's a when the English invaded Ireland for the 15th time, but one time they invaded, Sir Walter Raleigh gathered all the clan chiefs together and all the important men, just cut all their heads off, put the heads on spikes outside his tent as a warning to anyone who would defy the English. Now, this warning is something that the English did, just rip the enemy apart to scare the enemy. It's a very, very good psychological tactic, but I'm getting off track. There's another, in 2010, this war, 2010, a paper came out arguing that there is evidence near Durango, Colorado, that this warfare was related to competition and tribal warfare. And tribal warfare, no matter what tribe is doing, because I know Native Americans have gotten a really bad rap in media, and I'm not going to, you know, but everyone's ancestors have done this. It's even mentioned in the Bible that when you are in tribal warfare, you just wipe everyone out if you have an enemy. And the reason for that is you could end a 200-year-long war today. It's a very, very common thing. Jerry Diamond talks about it in one of his books, The World Until Yesterday. The New Guinea people talk about this. They did this, where you, instead of fighting for resources for 200 years, you just go and take care of the problem now. That may explain some of the 1997 excavations. Now, the Pueblo people, they're not gone. They're still around. They're just called different names now, the Hopi, the Zuni, and they're alive. And, you know, they do talk about this, but they don't. I read one article that said they have a tradition, oral tradition, in which they know what happened. They're just not telling the general populace. Because, you know, who wants to talk about something horrible that happened to your ancestors? And I've heard other read articles where they do talk about it. Just they just don't know exactly what happened. But I will tell you this. You know, they're still around. They didn't disappear. They just moved. And it's kind of funny. I was in Mexico and Chichen Itza, which is a Mayan city that was found abandoned by the Spanish. It was all grown with weeds. It's very impressive. There's those beautiful, beautiful temples and houses, and it's a beautiful city. And someone in the tour group said, "So how did the Mayans disappear?" And he said, "They didn't disappear. But didn't they, this is just when that, around that 2012 stuff was happening, but didn't they just disappear?" And he said, "No. They're, some of them host tours here. They're still Mayan. They're still Mayan people. They just wear, you know, blue jeans and t-shirts." And they point to a tour guide and said, "That guy's Mayan over there." And he's like me. He has a PhD in archaeology. So don't be fooled by media portrayals of situations. But I'll tell you that after looking at some of the photos of Chaco, I'm going there. I am absolutely going there. I'm going to go on a tour. I'm going to go to some of these places. I'm going to go and go to some of the cliffside villages. They're absolutely beautiful, stunningly beautiful. And I encourage all of you too. So thanks for bearing with me. Thank you for putting up with me, despite the fact my beautiful co-host isn't here. Now, next week, the plan is to try something we haven't tried before. Now, I promised you gangsters. I promised you the Quay Brothers, but I didn't want to do it without Patty. But I want to review a book that I've read in the past. It's called My Uncle Al. I thought about this because of the Tom Hardy movie that just came out. Al Capone's great niece, the granddaughter of his brother, whose nickname was Bottles, because he owned a legitimate milk bottling plant. She lives in Dearborn, Minnesota, believe it or not. Wrote a book called My Uncle Al about him. And it's very nice. She's not saying he's a saint. She's just saying he really wasn't as bad as the media portrayed him because everyone was out to get him. Which, fair enough, he was Al Capone. I can't wait to reread it, review it. I'll probably go over it with you guys, and we'll see. I would recommend getting the book, or if your local library, and I know COVID, a lot of libraries are closed, but if yours is open, I recommend that you safely go there. You know, if there's, obey all the safety regulations. If, you know, don't go there recklessly, I might say so. Or if you have Audible, or, you know, that's available on Audiobook, go ahead and get it. And if you like to cook, there's all the Capone family recipes in the back, which I think was a far bigger betrayal on her part than just talking about Al. So we're going to review that book, and then we are going to do the Outlaw of Pass incident. There's a very good book on that called The Dead Mountain that I plan to read as well. I'm not going to review the book. I'm just going to go over the book for inspiration, as well as research the incident. Thank you all so much for listening. Thank you for your dedication. I really am so happy all of you are listening. Every single download makes me happy, and I really mean that. So thanks again, and don't worry, next episode Patty will be here for the Dyatlov Pass, at least. And remember, without history, you wouldn't be here. Bye, everybody.